April 17, 1975, the Khmer Rouge marched into Phnom Penh and turned the clock back to year zero. The Khmer Rouge was one of the most lethal regimes of the 20th century. It was responsible for the deaths of millions of Cambodians. Following their leader, Pol Pot, the Khmer Rouge imposed an extreme form of social engineering on Cambodian society, a radical form of agrarian communism where the whole population was forced to work on collective farms or forced labor projects. One of their mottos was, "To keep you is no benefit, to destroy you is no loss." The Khmer Rouge was overthrown on January 7, 1979, by Vietnamese forces. The end of the Khmer Rouge period was followed by a civil war, which ended in 1998.
In 1997, the government requested United Nations assistance in establishing a trial to prosecute the senior leaders of the Khmer Rouge. In 2001, the Cambodian National Assembly passed a law to create a court to try serious crimes committed during the Khmer Rouge regime. This court is called the Extraordinary Chambers in the Courts of Cambodia for the Prosecution of Crimes Committed During the Period of Democratic Kampuchea. It is a Cambodian court with international participation that will apply international standards. But for regular citizens of Cambodia, these proceedings are beyond their means, financially and emotionally. After over 30 years of war and genocide, the citizens of Cambodia are focused on their survival, not engaging in judicial proceedings.
Tonight on Circle A Radio, we'll be talking with Bavia Wagner, Executive Director of Friends of Cambodia, activist, lawyer, and Asian reporter columnist Polo, and we'll also hear audio from the documentary Cambodian Culture, Death of a Sideshow, Reclaiming the Shattered Past, produced by Barbara Bernstein in 1987. Stay tuned.
This is Bavia Wagner.
I'm the Executive Director of Friendship with Cambodia and the founder. The organization was started 5 years ago, in 2003, and basically coordinating the organization. We have partner organizations in Cambodia that we work with, and we have a lot of volunteers and board members that are all active and helping raise money on this end and do education about Cambodia. The U.S. became involved in Cambodia around 1969 when the U.S. started bombing. This was during the Vietnam War, and the bombing was to, of course, you know, get the Viet Cong that were supposedly hiding in Cambodia. And first of all, the bombing was illegal because Cambodia was a neutral country, and it's against international law to bomb a neutral country during a war. But the U.S. continued bombing for 4 years, and during that time, we dropped more bombs on Cambodia than all the bombs dropped in World War II. This is a country about the size of Kansas. Hundreds of thousands of people became refugees, fleeing the bombings. You know, tens of thousands of people died. And the other thing was the king was overthrown. The whole political stability of the country collapsed. And, you know, a general, Lon Nol, who was supportive of U.S. policies, was in. So that threw the whole country into chaos, and it really just set the stage for the genocide to take place. So in 1975, the Khmer Rouge took over, and the Khmer Rouge is an extremist group within the Communist Party. And they had a very cruel vision of, let's say, they had an idealistic vision of the utopian society, which would be a society without class. And this did arise out of the injustices in the country of the disparity between the rich and the poor and how the poor were so mistreated by the wealthy people. But their idea of creating the society was so cruel because they decided to execute everyone with an education.
My name is Ronald Latang Sayang Katalani. Folks call me Polo for short. I'm an activist, attorney, and I write locally essays for Asian Reporter. For 4 years, called the Dark Years, there was a rule by a kind of hyper-communist leader who was actually educated at in Paris, in Sorbonne, with these concepts of, I don't know, a Leninist state where everybody would be equal. And out of that came many things. One of them is a movie called Killing Fields. And that movie started and ended, I think, with a John Lennon song, Imagine Everyone Being Equal and No Religion and No Money, No Property. And this is, I suppose, what Mr. Pol Pot and his Khmer Rouge regime tried to accomplish in Cambodia. But what he did instead is half the country's population. So we can argue, and people do, did 2.5 million people perish, or was it 3 million, or was it 4 million? You cannot say. But it's for sure a country soaked with sorrow.
This clip is from the documentary Cambodian Culture, Death of a Sideshow.
Bodhi Ut had grown up in Phnom Penh. He was 10 years old when the Khmer Rouge took over. During the regime, he worked as a farmer and laborer.
That time, there was a shift in the leaders in my district. The Southwest Khmer Rouge came to the Northeast zone where I lived, and the new Khmer Rouge were horrible, and they killed their own Khmer Rouge. They killed the real good leaders.
When the Vietnamese come into Kampong Cham, we go up to the soldiers to tell them that we want to leave.
Madame Mom Kamel had been a classical dancer before the revolution. During the Pol Pot years, her family hid their identity and managed to stay together.
During that time, the Khmer Rouge people are killing each other. We are happy that the Vietnamese come because no one can sleep at night because of all the killing. The Khmer Rouge are even killing their own family.
When the Vietnamese invaded, there were a lot of rumors.
Sadien Che was a classical singer before the war. She lost most of her family during the Khmer Rouge years.
They told us that if the Vietnamese find you, they will kill you or tie you together by your ears. When I did meet the Vietnamese, they let us walk freely, and they were much better to us than the Pol Pot people had said.
When Vietnamese took over Cambodia, all my leaders, they ran away.
Huynh Vuc Che had been a student before the revolution. When the Vietnamese invaded, he was working as a fisherman at Tonle Sap, a huge lake in central Cambodia.
We have boats, so we rode the boat from Tonle Sap to Bat Mbong.
When the Vietnamese take over Cambodia, there's at least more freedom to move around the country. I did not want to go back to my hometown because I did not want to be reminded of my family. So I decided to go to Bat Dambong.
Again, this is Bavia Wagner of Friends of Cambodia.
The way the genocide ended was Vietnam invaded Cambodia and ousted the Khmer Rouge. And they invaded because the Khmer Rouge had started attacking Vietnam. But after they invaded, they basically stayed and occupied the country for both altruistic and opportunistic purposes. They did sort of loot most of the wealth out of the country, but then they also brought in doctors and teachers and helped rebuild the country. You know, at that point in time, in 1979, there were only 50 doctors left in the entire country. 75% of the teachers had died. So it was an amazing state of shambles. And that year, not enough rice was planted, so people were starving. You know, there were refugee camps set up at the border.
Again, from the documentary produced in 1987 by Barbara Bernstein.
I had no rice to eat at that time.
Sadien Che.
I picked vegetables from the field and traded them in the market for rice. I tried exchanging different things to get clothes. I had one diamond ring I had hid from the Khmer Rouge, and I sold that ring for a bag of rice in order to continue my journey. I smuggled food between villages and got enough rice to exchange it for some gold. Then I met up with my aunt, and we got the idea to go to the border together.
After a few months, I found my older sister,
Bodhi Ut.
And we heard the rumors about the border. In that time, there were people smuggling stuff from the border to the Cambodia, and we wanted to go there because there was food for us, and there was something that we could do. And we had nothing left in Cambodia. We cannot go back to our old house.
I never hope to escape. Never hope and never dream to escape. I'm afraid about walking in the forest. We didn't know where we have to go.
And I heard the radio of Americans say we have a new camp open, it's Kawedang.
Chandrasrey.
So I ran to Thailand, myself and my wife, because I know we could not stay there anymore.
I heard everybody say that the United Nations High Commission on Refugees was helping people at the border and giving them food.
Chen Saw was a peasant. He left Cambodia after the Vietnamese invasion.
I decided to get my family and go to Kawedang. The main reason that I leave my country is that the Khmer Rouge were communists and the Vietnamese are still communists, and I am scared of the communists. I want to live in a country with liberty.
Again, this is lawyer and Asian reporter columnist Polo.
Out of that time, then, in 1979, Vietnam, the neighboring country, invaded Cambodia and got rid of Pol Pot and that Khmer Rouge regime. They were on the run for a while. Many hundreds of thousands of Cambodians fled, mostly into Thailand, and lived in refugee camps, and many ended up in the United States. And in Portland, let's say, there is now 5,000 to 7,000 living here, working hard, bringing their bright, brave children to school every morning and are part of our community.
Bavia Wagner.
So gradually the country started rebuilding, but it had a lot of difficulty because of two things. One was the U.S., because Vietnam was occupying Cambodia, the U.S. Considered Cambodia our enemy. We blocked humanitarian aid to Cambodia through the United Nations. So for the next 12 years, no aid from Western countries was allowed into Cambodia. The other thing that happened was the refugee camps on the border of Thailand, instead of repatriating the refugees, you know, within a year or two, those camps became sort of politically strategic bases for a civil war that then lasted for another 20 years. This was many political factions, including the Khmer Rouge, fighting against the new Cambodian government, which was backed by Vietnam. So actually the U.S. became an ally of the Khmer Rouge and helped fund that civil war through those refugee camps, giving humanitarian aid that was then sold for weapons. So anyway, that war continued actually right up until the death of Pol Pot in 1998. Again, it was difficult for the country to rebuild when there was a civil war going on.
Again, this is from Cambodian Culture, Death of a Sideshow.
Some area taken by Heng Samrin troops, we have a paper attached to the tree to let everybody read his plan for school, for everything, food. Would you join me? We have a plan to help you. Even we didn't trust the Vietnamese, but I trust Heng Samrin.
Van Chiem had worked for the Ministry of Education before the revolution. For 4 years, she hid her identity as an intellectual and learned to be a farmer. She was one of a few former teachers who survived.
They need me to organize primary school, secondary school, universities. If I didn't join the Vietnamese government, I had nothing to eat. Everything had to be changed. We tried to write another book in order to change the idea from the freedom mind to the socialist mind. Everybody had to get the brainwashed. I was at that time director of the socialist politics school, so we have to call the teacher from the other provinces to re-educate in Phnom Penh, the experts sent from Hanoi, and taught what way we have to teach the new generation to be a socialist.
Again, this is Bavia Wagner of Friends of Cambodia.
So things started getting a little better for Cambodia, you know, after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. At that point, Vietnam withdrew its troops and occupation of Cambodia. The UN came in, and the U.S. was supportive again of Cambodia and the democratic elections. So now the U.S. is supportive of Cambodia. We've, we're helping with some of the landmine removal. We're helping with democracy building. And the U.S. is also, for a while, gave favorable economic trade status so that Cambodia could get a garment industry established. That trade status actually is ending this year. But so now the U.S. is more involved in helping support Cambodia. So I first went to Cambodia in 1991. It was with a citizens' diplomacy group actually going to Vietnam, and some of the people in that group had worked in the Cambodian refugee camps, and so they were interested in visiting Cambodia, and I went with them. It was still under the rule of the Vietnamese government, communist government, and it was amazing how impoverished the country was. The children were all skinny, dressed in rags. We didn't see any passenger cars in the whole country. It was just cargo trucks. I just came to realize that the whole country was still in a state of shock following the genocide, which had happened 12 years earlier, but, you know, it was still dramatically affected at that point. I just wanted to do something to help, and I'd started out by the following year I led an educational study tour to the area and also actually to Vietnam, and then went back to Cambodia and started working with women's groups there, helping them market their handicrafts in the U.S. Then Cambodia, the communist government, fell and it became a democratic country, so it became more easy to do work there. I started leading educational tours there and then went on to write my book and start this organization. The book is titled Soul Survivors, Stories of Women and Children in Cambodia. It's a collection of 14 stories of people who survived the genocide, and it tells a little bit about, they each tell a little bit about their life before the genocide, during the genocide, and then after, how they rebuilt their lives following. It's currently out of print, but it's about to be republished in May. And, I decided to write the book after I heard the story of this one orphan in Cambodia, and he was our tour guide, and his father was an architect and had been killed by the Khmer Rouge. And this boy was 12 years old, and his mother died as well. You know, during the genocide under Pol Pot, everybody was put in work camps, families were separated, people weren't given enough food to eat, there weren't doctors, people were overworked and dying from just exhaustion. So this young boy was very clever and managed to survive, and at the end of the genocide, he just followed people fleeing the country and ended up in a refugee camp orphanage. But he got lucky, and he got adopted by a family in Minnesota. A minister's family adopted him. He actually had sort of a struggle, you know, none of the homes he lived in worked for him until finally one foster family, it worked out. And he stayed on, worked his way through college. And after he graduated college, he decided to go back to Cambodia to help rebuild his country. And his story touched me a lot. His name is Sarong, and his story's in my book. Just as I was working in Cambodia with the different women's associations, I, you know, met more people and heard their stories and found that almost everybody in Cambodia had a somewhat similar story of, you know, the tragic loss during the genocide and then noble efforts to rebuild their lives. I feel like their stories really talk about the tragedy of war and genocide, but they also are testimony to the strength of the human spirit. In spite of all the cruelty and hardship that people experienced, the kindness in their heart survived, and they came through it with a willingness to and a desire to help and help rebuild. And of course, that story is not true for everyone. Certainly, some people couldn't survive and, committed suicide when they found all their family had died. But many people are just nobly, helping rebuild the country. Friendship with Cambodia is focused on providing, humanitarian aid to Cambodia. Our philosophy of relief work is to empower people, and it's easy to go to Cambodia and notice the extreme poverty and want to just, build houses, build schools, fix people's problems. But in the long run, that's not a solution. We really need to empower the people to make long-term changes in their own lives. So most of our projects focus on credit and education. Both lend themselves towards long-term empowerment. We're working in 5 areas, and they're areas that we consider where the dire need is in Cambodia. One is with families with AIDS. Another is working with children and women that are trafficked. Another is working with the survivors of landmine accidents. We're also working with street children, and the 5th area is rural poverty. With many of those programs, we have scholarships sponsoring students to go to school to get an education. And in Cambodia, the level of education is still quite low. 75% of the children who start school, only about 2/3 of them actually do start school. Anyway, 75% drop out of school between 3rd grade and 6th grade. Only 12% actually graduate high school. So we're funding poor students to be able to finish high school and go on to college. And so many of them are choosing to become teachers and doctors. And then for the landmine survivors, we have a vocational training program because I should mention the problem of landmines in Cambodia. There's still 4 to 6 million landmines in the ground, and every day 2 or 3 people step on a mine. And most of the people are farmers or people living in the rural areas. And following their accident, they really can't work on their farm anymore, so they need another means of livelihood. So we have a vocational training program for them. They can choose between motorcycle repair, sewing, or electronics repair, which would be TVs, VCRs, DVD players. Occupations that people can still live in their rural communities and serve, their community that way. And another very successful program is the women's self-help groups and small loan programs. Last year, a Nobel Peace Prize was awarded to the founder of the Grameen Bank, Muhammad Yunus, who started this whole project of providing small loans. These are loans of $30 to $50 to women to start some kind of income generation project. It might be raising chickens or pigs or buying fishing equipment or getting the equipment so they can make a little noodle stand. So once the women have increased their income, they tend to do things like improve the nutrition of their family, which is really important in Cambodia because 45% of the children are malnourished. They also usually try to get their children in school. They want their children to get an education. Now they have money to repair their house if it's, leaking, or they can buy medicine when someone's sick. So these are all ways of really improving the quality of life for people with a very small investment. So that's one of the credit programs.
You've done a lot of work personally taking Americans to Cambodia. Will you talk about the trips?
Yeah, I think it's wonderful to be able to go over to Cambodia and see these things with your own eyes. I mean, it just touches your heart to see both the beauty of the country. So many people love to see the Angkor Wat, the ancient temples of Angkor Wat. They're beautiful. And the people there are very gracious, gentle, kind people, and the culture is that way, and the people are that way. And when you hear about how so many of them lost their families and are really struggling financially, I mean, the average income for a Cambodian, the average annual income is about $280. We realize how lucky we are in this country and how a little bit of help in Cambodia can go such a long ways. I mean, you know, $30 or $50 can change the life of a whole family forever. We just begin to realize that there's so much we could do to help, and it's just so satisfying to see the changes in people's lives. So our tours are focusing on taking people to see both the tourist sites in Cambodia, the temples and so forth, but also to visit the nonprofit organizations that we're working with there so that we can meet people who have been struggling and have turned their lives around with a little bit of help. And then another part of the tour, the next tour is going to be in February 2009, and we're calling it a service trip because we're also going to be volunteering a little bit of our time practicing English with the students and taking some of the orphans on a field trip and, you know, other activities like that.
Again, this is lawyer and columnist with the Asian Reporter, Polo.
Cambodia was really a failed state. After Vietnam withdrew, Cambodia could fall back into chaos. And by chaos, I mean small armies running regions and without a central government and without law and order. So the United Nations stepped in with, I believe, 40,000 bureaucrats, civil servants and alike, and settled in Phnom Penh and tried to put together as quickly as possible a civil society of government, of courts, of schools, of human administration, and selected a government. It wasn't the best government. Many people would say it's the worst government. And many of the leaders of the apparatus of the new government have been called or thought of as former Khmer Rouge party. Khmer Rouge is Red Cambodian, Communist Cambodian Party. So there's been some shoving matches, of course, and on who gets to run the country, but many people considered connected with that old murderous regime are still there.
You're listening to Circle A Radio on KBOO 90.7 FM, 100.7 FM Corvallis, and 91.9 FM in the Columbia Gorge. We've been listening to interviews with Bobbia Wagner of Friends of Cambodia and Asian reporter, columnist, and lawyer Polo.
There has been a kind of process of deciding who to punish, a highly political process, and who not. And in the meanwhile, many of the real leaders have passed away, have gotten old. Pol Pot himself died in a shack somewhere and was burned along with some tires and some rubbish as a sign of, you know, mortal disrespect for his soul by his countrymen. Now, I cannot tell you exactly, but I imagine there's a small handful, three or five, toothless old men standing trial for the atrocities, for the torture and eventual death of millions of people, either through neglect in labor camps and disease, or executed. Okay, so that tribunal is rolling forward at a snail's pace now.
Again, this is Bobbia Wagner of Friends of Cambodia.
Most people in Cambodia are not focusing on the tribunals. They're really focusing on daily survival. So the farmers are really just, I mean, 85% of the people in Cambodia are rural. Most of them are farmers. And so they're just living on a day-to-day existence of trying to get enough food to eat, grow their crops, and so forth. So I'd say that overall it's not having much of an effect. But, you know, when I interviewed people for my book, people would always say, we want to know why Khmer killed Khmer, or, you know, Cambodians killed Cambodians. That it's just sort of beyond comprehension why people would kill their own people. I think they're looking for these, you know, leaders to explain that, the leaders of the Khmer Rouge. I mean, that's one thing that they would be looking for in these tribunals, is to have an explanation as to why did they do that.
So I'm interested in personally if you think that's going to happen, and also the effects still of the genocide and the civil war, and like the post-traumatic stress disorder, and what's your personal feelings about the timing?
Well, the timing, I mean, I think that it, you know, it should have happened a long time ago. But people are still so, you know, greatly affected by the genocide. I mean, their families have been torn apart, broken up. You can hardly find a Cambodian over 40 who didn't have family members die during the genocide. I mean, almost everybody was affected by it. People are still having health problems, physical health problems, mental health problems as a result of that experience. And it shattered the trust that people have in each other. When you were betrayed, or when, you know, people you trusted became killers, all of a sudden you don't know who you can trust. And that has sort of prevented people from working together to rebuild the country in some ways. I think it's good that the tribunals are taking place, and it's probably a little late. I mean, it is late because, of course, Pol Pot has died, the leader of the genocide, as well as some of the other top leaders.
Because of the format of the proceedings, at one point, for example, you had to pay a $5,000 bar association fee to be either defend or prosecute, because attorneys from the West, from Europe and America, are coming then to assist in the prosecution of a society that's basically lost its well-educated folks. It's lost its lawyers, judges, and so on. And there was a $5,000 fee to participate in these proceedings, and that was considered a lot, since that's probably 10 times more than a person makes per year on average in Kampuchea. So it was lowered to $500. And it's that kind of thing where, you know, we're missing the point entirely of what these proceedings are about. As an activist in communities, I'm more concerned about people who are struggling with deep, deep sorrow, with broken bones and hearts that are not going to be repaired ever. I'm more concerned, and I'm not just speaking for me, but I think I'm speaking for folks in the local leadership here of Cambodian communities, and the real caring and conscientious folk back home in Kampuchea. Our concern really is with regular people, not with the prosecution and maybe hanging of somebody who's 80 years old. By the way, there's no capital punishment in Cambodia as a result of working out a legal system that is consistent with European standards, for a second, EU standards. So at best, you could be prosecuted and found guilty. Another problem, and I think this is more interesting, it's easily more important from our perspective as family people, is you can't have a killing machine in Nazi Germany or in Khmer Rouge, Cambodia, without people carrying it out. Of course, there are leaders issuing orders downtown, but there are people who are working every day, 8 to 5, so to speak, at the job of crushing a population, of executing people, of transporting people to where they need to be executed. All of that's a society. And, you know, I think Westerners faced this problem in Nazi Germany. In Israel, you have the same problem of having a set of policies that are criminal. But the policies are carried out by working folks just like me who and you all who have salaries and show up every day and take lunch breaks and coffee. Are we going to punish those people too? And everyone certainly has relations who were 14, 16, 18, 20-year-old boys hacking people, shooting people, driving folks to mass graves, and all of that. Who do you punish, actually? This is the interesting question. And maybe that's not so much a punishment question, because, you know, in teachings of Buddha, you are punished for sure in your life. Knowing how it is you've lived is itself punishment, to say nothing of your reincarnation. But the bigger question is us, those who suffer. And everyone has suffered, both the oppressors and those oppressed. That's the larger healing question that this enormously expensive, super-duper politicized effort in Cambodia called the Khmer Rouge tribunals is trying to do all at once and not doing well.
Again, this is lawyer and Asian reporter columnist Polo.
We have mountains of respect for the Lion of Africa, Nelson Mandela, and Bishop Archbishop Desmond Tutu for their approach at finding justice and to allow people a chance to say what they did wrong publicly. And if you do, then you know you will be treated completely different from people who are hearing your remorse and your wrongdoing than if we have to prosecute you, because now we're going to spank you. And of course, that process is—it's not only easier if you admit your wrongs, but a healing happens, and healing is more important and so different from punishing. Punishing makes more anger, more rage, more sorrow. Everyone has family members who will suffer for your punishment. As family people, we need to understand this. So yeah, that is, I suppose, from a ethnocultural perspective, a much more effective way of moving forward. And we wish people would follow the lead of the Lion of Africa rather than EU systems of prosecuting or American, Anglo-American legal systems of assigning blame. What do folks think might be a better way of approaching this? And it's hard for me to speak for everyone, but I can tell you what I have observed in Portland, Oregon, with CACO, Cambodian American Community of Oregon leadership, profoundly effective moral authority style leadership. What folks did here is put together, with their own time, with their own money, with their own hearts, with their own hands, a 2.5-day forum on the Khmer Rouge tribunal. And what I saw happening was folks who put this effort on and staged it at the Immigrant and Refugee Communities of Oregon multipurpose room at PSU in the days to follow, whole day conversations, including experts, prosecutorial experts, human rights experts, humanitarian relief experts, mental health experts. Aside from all that, from what all of the experts had to say or do, folks put on that event, through that process, were at last engaged. Engaged as vigorous, as purposeful, as self-fixing human beings. No longer passive recipients. Passive recipients of brutality, or passive recipients of United Nations paternalistic sort of, let us help you, we're so generous. We're coming from the outside because we know better than you do how to make life better for you. But they themselves put together a wonderfully moving, sad, happy 2.5-day event of telling their own stories and affirmatively handling that. It was that process of putting that on that made it happen. Do you remember there was a traditional Khmer musician who came, and forgive me for not remembering his name, and for Cambodian listeners, for me forgetting his name. But he was to perform, and he did. And then there was a number written for this event, and he started to play and sing. I don't know if you remember this. And he stopped, and he could not continue. He couldn't do it. He tried, couldn't do it. The silence of his inability to express his heartbreak was more profound than any song we could have heard. That moment, his silence, and we saw it so many times, of women I didn't know were so victimized, coming up to the microphone with their pictures of the sister and the mother and the auntie hacked to death and telling people this happened to her and not being able to get the idea out of her mind at night. For the first time ever, telling each other, telling her children who are teenagers, that this is how I grew up. And the silence when they were not able to speak further and then and left the stage in tears was more profound, you know, than anything in any book, any Times font, you know, on legal proceedings, or any of the experts who were sitting in panels. I mean, they were terrific. They're wonderful human beings. But this moment, these that we all understand without college educations, from people who didn't even speak English but who were there to feel it, was so profound, so deep, so meaningful. So I would suggest that's the way we get to justice. It would be wonderful to see in all American cities, take Long Beach, California, which is probably as many Cambodians as Cambodia, ghetto Cambodians we call them, you know, just a rugged, awful community in many ways. Of course, very good in many ways, but I, given my profession, deal with disasters of a couple of generation of young men not knowing what to do, of a couple of generation of people who are an immense public health problem for their unaddressed trauma, sorrow. It would be wonderful to take the lead of CACO in these American Cambodian communities and then back home. I don't mean nationally, but by province or by cities, and have people organize now this event where they get to get their arms around what happened from a mental health point of view, from a medical point of view, from a juridical point of view, from a spiritual point of view, whatever, in music, in poetry, in witnesses' statements, among each other, crying together, arguing together. I think that's a much better way of creating a new positive Cambodian identity, not in blame, in 30 years looking backwards, trying to find some toothless old man to hang, but in consolidating now where we are. Cambodians, as you may know, are almost an unspeakably generous and open-hearted people, even given all they've been through. That is where the new Cambodian identity needs to be, I think, in their rich and their elegant and ancient music, not in the title of a movie, Killing Fields. I mean, we've almost, you know, taken up this cliché created by mainstream America, the Killing Fields. That's who we are. Of course that happened, but these folks are so much more muscular than that. Portland, because of our size and because of how good leadership is here, with Southeast Asians, with Asians in general, with Asian Americans, have done better than other cities. So if I were to answer your question about Cambodian health in Portland, it has failed to be addressed well for the same reasons minority health is not addressed well everywhere in America. In fact, for the same reasons women's health was not addressed well, you know, until 12, 15 years ago, and taken seriously as a legitimate subject for experimentation, for research, for categories of government. So minority health has been a problem. It's minority health, and no one really knows what this means. You know, we don't have the same issues as African Americans, as Asians. And Koreans, as Asians, have different issues from Cambodians. In fact, we were not Asians until recently. I remember the day, it was 1972 or something, Mr. Nixon's Secretary of Commerce created a new category for the census. Census comes out of the Department of Commerce. So the Census Bureau created this category called Asians, which is cool because we'd never been that before. Because back home, you know, Koreans and Cambodians are not at all alike. It starts with K's or C's. That's about it. Beyond that, you know, Thai and Taiwan, what is the difference except starting with a T? So now Asian health is an issue here, but Cambodian health is what we're talking about. And again, I can talk about how I see things because I'm usually at the disaster end, that is trying to fix broken parts and broken hearts. And I can tell you that we have enormous anger and rage, of course, for men in our communities. As an example, you know, there is a gentleman, and he's not the only one, but he is a very kind Cambodian guy in his late 30s, and he works very, very hard, and is never late, and dutifully places the check in his wife's hand at the end of every month. On weekends, he's available to drive aunties and grandmas to temple, or to medical appointments, dental appointments during the week. He's just a sweet man. But he has these fits of rage that will not be done until he's done. And that includes breaking furniture, broomsticks, mopsticks, lamps, whatever, usually over his wife, and sometimes over his oldest sons. There's another man who is the same way, and his sons are the same way. And we have moved now into a second generation of rage, inexplicable black rage. I'm not saying every household is this way, but we have that kind of unresolved sorrow. And men will act out this way. You know, women will destroy themselves and their families in other ways. I'm not a woman, so I'm not so good at addressing that, but I can tell you about men, about humiliated men, or men who in important parts of their lives have gotten used to brutality, and where you go all of a sudden when you flip into that biochemical state of having been a victim of brutality and now a perpetrator of it. It's the same state. It's the same state. And just sort of the problem of us now punishing Khmer Rouge, you know, the victim and the perpetrator are the same people. They are the same biochemical event. It's hard to say who's guilty. But now, for purposes of abbreviation, we have people who have been brutalized going downstream. And of course, predating on weaker people who we give them license to predate on. Men predate on women and children. There's something happening with these folks, and to call it post-traumatic stress is really not enough. You know, back in the mid and late 70s, this was a new category of mental illness, researched, refined, and drug-treated, you know, by, among other people, OHSU's faculty. And we have since then actually had a clinic. It was originally called Indo-Chinese Mental Health, and now it's moved to being called International Psychiatric Program and so on. But they have operated on that same model of these folks suffering from PTSD because the research has gone no further. Unhappily, the treatment modality for that tends to be Western. That is group therapy, not very persuasive, you know, for Asians. We don't quite do that, or drugs. And so that program has had mixed results. They have seen folks and have healed, I believe, or treated people well, but not enough people go there. And I think it's fair to say that a number of our national, ethnic, and cultural groups won't go there. Hmong, for example. Hmong Highlanders will not allow their men to be medicated in this way. Right? They have the same kind of experience and the same kind of horror in their bones, but they have their ways of dealing with this, either through the shamanic tradition or running around with fellas in the bush, running down deer and squirrels and whatever guys like to do. But they won't allow themselves to be part of this modality. We have created in that program, I have to say, a kind of category of mentally ill people who the rest of the community looks down on as drugged out, emasculated men who can't work, don't work. And we, traditional people, don't like that. Men need to work. Men need to provide and protect for their children. And if you are sort of esteemed as being someone who doesn't or won't, you know, men, it creates a problem for your family, for your reputation. Yeah, and you get stuck in a characterization of being mental. And Asians don't deal well with mental. Maybe most traditional people don't. So, yeah, there we have an awful long ways to go. And I think to go back again to this leadership example of CACO, the local Cambodian American Community of Oregon, putting on this event, I think that's where the solution to their public health issues needs to come from their leadership saying, wow, we're hurt, aren't we? Let's sit around and talk about this and let them direct what kind of treatment, what kind of healing needs to take place. I think it's fair to say that in America, the mainstream has not dealt well with many people's mental health issues. American Indians are really neglected. African Americans are left to fend for themselves. So this is a long line, and Asians, Southeast Asians, are at the end of all that. It's more likely we will find those solutions in communities, in households, in neighborhoods, rather than expecting them to come from, I don't know how to say this, but from white folks on down. And I don't mean to say that in a critical way. It's just, you know, establishments are what they are, and they are huge institutions that don't turn around for a rather small, for a minuscule minority like subgroup Asian, subgroup Southeast Asian, subgroup Cambodians.
Again, this is Bhavya.
Cambodia is off the radar for most Americans. I mean, we're not thinking about Cambodia, but the main thing is that it's an extremely impoverished country, largely in part because of former U.S. policies, not to make judgments, but to just say that at this point in time, it's time to, you know, help Cambodia rebuild. So I think as Americans, it's just important for us to do what we can to support Cambodia as it rebuilds. And I feel that, you know, donating your money to nonprofit organizations that are helping Cambodia is really the best way that we can help. The nonprofit organizations, you know, like Friendship with Cambodia, are helping Cambodians become empowered to solve their own problems. Many of the problems in Cambodia, whether it's, you know, AIDS, trafficking, street children, or so forth, they really all arise from the poverty there, you know, which is in part a remnant of, you know, the genocide, the U.S. bombing, 30 years of civil war. So I think that addressing the issue of poverty is really key in terms of solving these problems. And the process is not to come in and fix people's problems, but instead to support them in solving their own problems.
Again, this is Polo.
CACO has their own website, and it's best to start there. And they have a new president, Ritia Yang. Yeah, so CACO is something you can look up on the web, or contact me at Asian Reporter. I'll give you people's names and numbers, and we can go eat noodles to excess and get folks started. There's a world of work to do. CACO does so many things, including their summer camps with kids, language schools, trips back home to Cambodia, humanitarian work, so that the young folks have a sense of where they're coming from. And it's just so important for Portlanders to get that there's so many kinds of Portlanders. And those of us who come from somewhere else have a psychological community, a continuous sort of circulatory system with back home. And I'm talking about the children of Mother Mexico as well as us, you know, sailors who came across the sea. We keep a continuing movement of people, things, money, ideas around, and we're happy to share.
To contact the Cambodian American Community of Oregon, go to www.cacoregon.org. Polo can be reached through the Asian Reporter, free at many locations locally, or at www.asianreporter.com. To learn more about Friendship with Cambodia, its projects and history, or to contact Bhavya Wagner, go to www.friendshipwithcambodia.org. To learn more about the Khmer Rouge and the Cambodian genocide, go to www.dccam.org, the Documentation Center of Cambodia. It has been at the forefront of documenting the crimes and atrocities of the Khmer Rouge era, or to www.yale.edu/CGP, which is the website for the Cambodian Genocide Study Program at Yale University.
We also have a recommended reading list at our website, www.kboo.fm/CircleA Radio. You can also leave us feedback, download this radio program, as well as our past shows. Circle A Radio airs the first and third Wednesday of the month from 6 to 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. Our next show will air April 2nd. Thanks for listening.